You're listening to a podcast from Washington Post Live, bringing the newsroom to you live.
Hello and welcome to Washington Post Live. My name is Aaron Davis. I'm an investigative reporter here at the Washington Post. And my guest today is Stephen Sund, the former chief of the U.S. Capitol Police. Chief Sund is the author of Courage Under Fire, Under Siege and Outnumbered 58-1. This is a book recounting in great detail the lead up to, the day of, and aftermath of January 6th. Chief Sund, you burst into public view in rather dramatic fashion in the immediate aftermath of January 6th for two reasons. Well, first, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called for your resignation, making you the face of law enforcement failures to head up the attack on the Capitol. And then secondly, very shortly after, my colleague Carol Lennig and I reported that days before the attack, you had requested that the National Guard be deployed to the Capitol, and that that request was rebuffed. And that became the first of what would become a very complex and disturbing picture of law enforcement and government failures. Following President Trump's call to have supporters come to the Capitol on January 6th, and that happened on December 19th, he said in that now infamous tweet, "Be there, will be wild." In the vein of lots of good Washington Post reporting over the years, I guess I'd like to start there. With the age-old question, what did law enforcement know and when did you know it? Did the threat change on that December 19th timeframe?
So the threat was coming up very similar to what we had seen before. The information we were getting from our intelligence unit and also the partner federal intelligence agencies were giving us the same level of intelligence that we'd seen. I call it MAGA 1, MAGA 2. It was the November MAGA rally, the Stop the Steal rally that happened in November. The same one that happened in December, I think it was 11th, 12th of December, where we were seeing, you know, indications that, you know, Proud Boys, some of the militia groups would be there, their expectations, some people would be armed. MPD had some armed people before with some of the demonstrations. So coming into the 6th, we were seeing the very same type of intelligence that was coming up, even to where, you know, my intelligence bulletins that I were getting were saying it is going to be similar to the previous two MAGA rallies coming up. So we expected a large group. The big difference we had was that for the 6th, you know, the previous events, they'd been going up and protesting the Supreme Court. So the target was the Supreme Court. For the 6th, their target would be Congress. They're trying to get Congress to sway to dispute the certification of the Electoral College. And we knew the protests were coming up to us. So with a joint session of Congress going on, I had a lot of personnel that I needed to put inside the Capitol to staff a lot of the posts there. So that's what made me go and ask for the National Guard on January 3rd.
Before we get to that National Guard part of the thing, which is so important, can you talk about, you said the intelligence looked the same that was coming from other agencies and your partners. We now know that there was such a flood of intelligence that had come into the FBI, to the Department of Homeland Security, and others. Can you talk specifically about the posture that law enforcement was in leading up to January 6th, and how much of that was because of the way that the FBI, being the lead law enforcement agency for domestic threats, were people taking their cues in D.C. from the FBI and from them saying a lot of these things they weren't quite worried about that were being said online?
So as a law enforcement agency, and your viewers will want to know, I'm the only law enforcement agency for the legislative branch, but we base all our operations on whatever information, whether it's called intelligence information, that we have at the time. And what was interesting, coming into January 6th, and I've been a police officer in Washington, D.C. for almost 30 years. I've handled a number of major events that had far lesser of a threat stream that I now know existed on January 6th, where the FBI would have done a number of things. It would have done a conference call with partner agencies, a joint intelligence bulletin with the Department of Homeland Security, or even an executive briefing for chiefs of police. We got none of that. And then when I started looking into the intelligence, you know, I was seeing that they were really getting a lot of tips and weren't taking proactive steps to start gathering intelligence for an event that we now know had significant threats being directed toward the Capitol, members of Congress, and elected officials.
Specifically on that Department of Homeland Security part, the bulletin, which is kind of this red flag that that goes up from DHS when they see something, was there anything that would have been triggered, would have changed in your world and at the Capitol Police if they had issued a bulletin or if FBI had said, we're really concerned about this?
Yes, it would have had, or even my own unit, if we had clearly outlined and provided the intelligence that I know now existed. When I went and asked for the National Guard on January 3rd, it was denied in part by Paul Irving because of the intelligence didn't support it. He didn't like the optics of the National Guard, but the intelligence didn't support it. If we did have intelligence that clearly showed, now we know groups were planning to attack the Capitol, groups had already surveilled some of my entry points. They knew the number of officers that were staffing some of these entry points. They knew our tunnel system. They knew our barrages. If we knew that existed, that would have given me the ammunition I needed on January 3rd or even earlier, because we knew, like you said, some of this intelligence existed all the way back to December 19th, December 20th. That would have given me the opportunity to go and ask for mutual aid from our partner law enforcement agencies, National Guard, and have the support to get it. Not only that, a bigger fence. My intelligence unit, the Protection and Intelligence Division or Bureau, has security services in it specifically so they can base the level of physical security, which would be the fencing. We had the bike racks out for this one, based on the intelligence. If the intelligence had clearly indicated that there was a pending attack on the Capitol, we would have put up probably the eight-foot anti-scale fencing that we do for the inauguration.
You've led me right to this point about 3 days before January 6th, where you, as you said, you requested help from the National Guard, or requested it from your bosses, to ask the National Guard, and that was rebuffed. That is such a fascinating day. We've now learned with all the things that were going on, at the White House, you had the president that day putting pressure on Mike Pence. You had, cabinet members meeting and talk and the head leaders in the Pentagon questioning private meetings if the permits should even be pulled for January 6th. And then, what is it specifically that's in your head that day that's making you say, I'm not quite comfortable with this? I want to ask the National Guard. I want more forces outside the Capitol that day.
So I had done a lot of major events in Washington, D.C. Again, I knew we had put a large ring of the bike rack around the Capitol grounds, which is a large area. The Capitol grounds, Capitol Square is a large area. And I knew I had a limited number of officers that'd be available to kind of staff that, to keep any of the protesters from trying to jump over it or just trying to try our perimeter. So when I went and asked, it was specifically because all I wanted was unarmed National Guard to help stand that perimeter to keep anybody from trying to jump over the bike rack. It was just based on my experience. It was Sunday morning that I went and asked, I think it was about 9:34 that I went and asked Paul Irving first, and got denied because I didn't like the look or the optics of the National Guard on Capitol grounds, and the intelligence didn't support it.
And later that day, we now know that your assistant chiefs, that there was that fuller security bulletin put together by your intelligence division, and that they wrote at the end of that in clearer language than had been done before that Congress they saw as the target. If you had even your own intelligence briefing a few hours earlier to take that to Irving, do you think that would have changed anything in that being the sergeant at arms there, you're one of your bosses at the Capitol?
So when you look at it again, there's been a lot of discussions about that final paragraph at the end of that 15-page intelligence report that said, Congress is the target. Well, every protest comes up to the Capitol, Congress is the target, but there was so many qualifiers that it may be dangerous. Now, people may come armed, militia may be there. They had a number of qualifiers in it that we now know if it had effectively provided the level of intelligence that we now know existed, that would have been a game changer.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's move on to the actual day, because of course that's still burned in everyone's mind. You had been the Capitol Police Chief for about a year and a half at that point, and for a quarter century had been with DC Police leading up to that. So you're certainly, as you said, familiar with large gatherings. That morning, can you walk us through what felt right, what felt off, what felt any different than you'd expected heading in to work that day?
Absolutely. I talk about it in the book in detail because I get up that morning. I talk about the night before going home, driving through the city, seeing the number of people in the city, the large Trump flags on cars driving around the city. So I come home. Next morning, I get up, get my cup of coffee, and I'm driving in. And as usual, I'll call and talk to some of my partner agencies. I called and talked to Robert Glover, who happened to be down by the Ellipse at the time. And, he gave me a rundown of what it looked like, large crowds. I believe he described it kind of as a mom and pop type of group, didn't expect any issues right then. So as I pulled into the command center, pulled over into my headquarters and went up to the command center, for me, it was looking like just another major event. We knew it was going to go long into the next morning because we knew there was going to be some objections to various certifications of the vote. So we anticipated it going till probably 9-10 o'clock the next morning, but didn't anticipate what we ended up with that day.
Yeah. You wrote in the book, and there is a great detailed timeline of events that day in the book. One of the first things you mentioned there is a tweet sent by then President Trump at 6 a.m. where he says, if Vice President Mike Pence comes through for us, we will win the presidency. How aware were you of that kind of information that was coming out that day, the president's tweets and other things that were being said that seemed to have later on, we know, egged down the crowd?
Yeah, so when I started researching the book and started writing the book, that's when I started looking at some of the tweets. At the time, I wasn't getting any of the real-time tweets coming in from the president. And I just thought it was really interesting the way it kind of fed into the timeline about, you know, what the thought process was down at the executive branch, 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, down the other end, Penn, as we're coming up on the attack, even during the attack. So I interlaced a number of tweets from the president throughout the day, throughout my timeline, as I do the TikTok through the attack. Because I just think it tells a very interesting story about, you know, kind of what some of the thought process were down at the White House, still trying to pressure the election.
Did you have any insight into what other law enforcement agencies were encountering? I mean, stuff that's even taken until like the recent few weeks to come out through the January 6th committee from Congress, that being that the Secret Service was spotting piles of bags at magnetometers that people were leaving behind, and that the park police, that radio communication that shows, you know, they were being overrun at the Washington Monument hours earlier. Did you have any of that in real time?
Yeah, I didn't have that. I did have that. I think it was MPD or park police, one of the two, had gotten somebody with a weapon that may have been in a tree. I did hear something about that, but nothing about the park police being overrun. Later on, I heard about, you know, people leaving bags or having issues at some of the magnetometers going in to the lips, or some people not even wanting to go through screening.
And so when was it really that you felt things were turning, that the tide was turning? There was obviously the, you know, more like the 1 to 2 p.m. hour that was so critical there. Was it that late when they really saw the crowd coming at the Capitol and you realized, walk us through that hour and kind of the, you know, the key moments for you?
Yeah, the key moment for me and was 12:53 p.m. You know, we were working with a pipe bomb that we had found over at the Republican National Committee right around 10 minutes earlier. So all that's going on at the time, you know, and picture this. I'm sitting in the command center at kind of a front desk. I have a couple of assistant chief to the right, assistant chief of mine to the left, and a couple other command staff around. And up in the front of me is probably about a dozen large video screens, all showing different parts of the Capitol grounds. So I'm sitting there kind of watching, looking down, you know, listening to the radio. My watch commander walked over a picture of the pipe bomb, which I was looking at. It had the wires, the end caps, the metal pipe, and the timer. And then somebody yells, there's a large crowd approaching our west front. 12:53 p.m. I will never forget that. I looked up and I saw this large crowd coming from the west across Peace Circle and Garfield Circle toward our officers on the bike racks that we had talked about being around our perimeter. Within minutes of hitting those officers on the bike rack, it became violent very quickly. I've never seen a protest get that violent that quickly with officers on a barrier. They immediately started yelling at them, punching at them, pulling the barrier away, dragging officers down the stairs. And at that moment, I knew this was going to be bad.
What was the first thing that you did?
So when I saw that, the very first thing I did is I had Chief Thomas, who's in charge of operations to my right. I looked down and noticed the officers on the barrier were all wearing kind of soft gear. It wasn't the big helmets, the turtle gear, the vest protectors that we usually see with CDU. And I turned to him and I said, you know, Chad, where's our CDU? Get our CDU down there now. And then the next thing I did was pick up the phone and call Jeff Carroll with Washington, D.C. Police. I talked to him a little bit earlier about maybe staging some of their CDU in the area. So I called him at 12:55. And when you remember watching the attack that was occurring as the crowd was coming up the west front and fighting with our officers, you'll see pictures of these bike officers, the MPD officers with the green jackets and the green and black jackets and the bicycle helmets come flooding into the picture. Those were the bike units that they had staged over on Constitution Avenue. And thank God they got there. I called Jeff within the first 2 minutes. they came flooding in. And I honestly believe if those officers hadn't been there, this group would have gotten up to the Capitol much faster, breached it much quicker, possibly trapping members of Congress in their chambers. Then my next call, 12:58, went to Paul Irving, requesting the assistance, the approval of the National Guard. And this is where it gets important. It gets important that your viewers realize that I am the only chief of police in the United States that has a federal law that prevents me from calling in federal resources, either before an event, like I tried to do on January 3rd, or during an attack, like it was happening on January 6th, without getting the board, the Capitol Police Board's approval. So that was my next call.
Wow. I'm glad that's one thing that's been changed in the aftermath here. Fast forward just a little bit. You're deep into it then, an hour and a half or so later, and there's this call that my colleagues and I spent a lot of time trying to figure out what happened on this call, which became kind of this crucible moment of the day, especially with regard to getting the National Guard, getting any other federal resources to the Capitol, other than the FBI, which kind of came in on their own. But can you tell us about this call? Did you begin it, and what were the key moments going on here?
I definitely want to set that call up because you had mentioned something earlier about the military being so concerned about violence at the Capitol that they talked about locking down the Capitol city and revoking permits on the Hill. What's interesting about that is, you know, the military makes up 9 of the 18 intelligence agencies. They seem to have such level of concern or level of intelligence that they wanted to revoke the permits. But guess what? I'm the one that issues those permits. And guess who they never told? Me. So here I am on the day of 1:50. I called General Walker because I still, from 12:58 through 2:09, you know, I've been repeatedly calling the Sergeant-at-Arms 11 times trying to find out where we were on my approval. While I'm calling, I made 32 calls, you know, bringing in support from other law enforcement agencies. When I called General Walker at 1:50, said, send me anything you got. I'm waiting for the Capitol Police Board to give me approval. Needless to say, I got approval at 2:09. At 2:34 p.m., I get a notification that the Pentagon wants me on a call. I finally get on the call after a couple of times trying to call in. And on the call is Lieutenant General Walter Piott. Lieutenant General Charles Flynn, brother Mike Flynn, is on it for part of the time. A number of other military brass, including a Colonel Earl Matthews that'll later become pivotal because he writes a scathing letter endorsing my story and not the general story. And then the mayor's chief of staff, and Robert Conte, the chief of the Washington, D.C. Police Department. When I get on the phone, Dr. Rodriguez from D.C. Homeland Security asked me, are you requesting the National Guard? And I will never forget this to this day. I said, yes, this is an urgent, urgent plea for the National Guard. We need them up here immediately. My men and women are getting beaten to a pulp. We need them. They had just breached the Capitol at that point. And I'll never forget this to this day. Lieutenant General Piott says, you know, I just don't like the optics of the National Guard on Capitol Hill. I would much rather relieve your personnel from traffic posts and let them get in the fight, and we'll take the traffic posts. I said, I don't have that option. Every officer, every man and woman of the department is in this fight. I need assistance now. This is an urgent, urgent plea. And again, he keeps going back. Well, you know, I just don't like the optics. He keeps referring to the optics of the National Guard, or the look of the National Guard on Capitol grounds. And this keeps going in a circle, and he keeps wanting to relieve my officers. I said, I don't have that option. I'm pleading, I'm begging, I'm literally almost in tears, begging for assistance, knowing the visuals I'm seeing up on the front of this command center, my officers being beaten to a pulp, being dragged around, being hit with bats, being hit with pipes, is the same images they're seeing in the Pentagon. They've got large screen TVs. They're watching the national news. And I'll never forget it. After going in circles a couple times, he turns and he says to me, my recommendation is not to support your request. I was dumbfounded. Conte then steps in and says, hold on a second. Are you denying the Capitol Police request? And again, he goes back to, I just don't like the look of the optics on that, on Capitol grounds, or the military on Capitol grounds. I'd much rather relieve these people from traffic posts. I said, I don't have that option. I need National Guard assistance now. I couldn't believe the delay I was facing. And this went on and on and on. And at 2:43, I heard over the radio inside the command center, shots fired in the Capitol. Shots fired in the Capitol. At that point, I was infuriated, picked up the phone, you know, still on the phone. I said, you know, there's shots fired in the Capitol. Is that urgent enough for you now? Ended the call because I had to get on the call with the Sergeant-at-Arms, tell about the shooting that we had, and didn't know if the National Guard was coming. They didn't arrive till 5:40 p.m. 5:40 p.m. They finally arrived, 150 of them. And you got to keep in mind, we had 150 National Guard soldiers right down the street from the Capitol, someone with an eyesight, and it turns out they had their riot gear with them. And they didn't move from that location. And the kicker is, they finally show up. We put them out on post. The fighting's over. Our perimeter's already resecured. We put them out on post. And what do? They line up and take a picture with the Capitol in the background, the very optic they didn't want to see.
If those National Guard soldiers had been able to get there in, you know, short order, what could they have done at that point in time with you know, the protesters, the rioters, kind of mixed in all the way through the Capitol? There wasn't a line necessarily to defend, except for trying to push them down the stairs and back out.
So we had set up a lot 16, which is right across the street from Capitol Police headquarters. And I talk about how we set up, because I've dealt with major events before and critical incidents like active shooters. So I knew we had resources coming in. I talked to Dave Bowditch over at the FBI about getting some of his personnel in as well. So we had a place for the resources to respond, and we had a system set up to move them to where they need to be so we can start methodically clearing the Capitol. We had established three criteria: secure the Capitol, clear the Capitol, and reestablish our perimeter. So as the resources came in, that's what we're doing. We're first trying to get inside, push the protesters out, and resecure the building, and then resecure the Capitol grounds. So they were the next largest cadre of personnel that we had close by besides the Washington, D.C. Police Department that could have been a critical resource for us. Think about that. 150, that 340 National Guard troops activated, but 150 could have been there in short order. That would have helped out considerably.
Mm-hmm. Was there ever a moment where you thought that you might not be able to regain control that day, or that, you know, this could become incredibly deadly? Was there a moment, perhaps around that the first shots fired, but is the one moment that you look back at that is the low point, the nadir that day?
When I first saw them hit the west front at 12:53, I knew it was bad. But as they got up, and people don't realize, it wasn't until 2:11 that the first window of the Capitol got broken. So 12:53 to 2:11, that's 80 minutes approximately that my officers defended every inch of ground. But as that group got closer and closer and closer to the Capitol, I started getting extremely concerned. And when we saw the big group on the east front that had been forming up, then all of a sudden started becoming agitated and violent with my officers and break through and start flooding toward the base of the Capitol. That is when I knew things were extremely bad.
So in the days afterward, obviously, you resign. The House Speaker starts that process, kind of calling out you and the sergeants at arms, saying that you need to start fresh. Resigning doesn't always happen these days. We've seen a lot of politicians, a lot of folks try to work through scandal and stay in their positions. I know you're right that looking back, you're not sure you should have resigned. But I'm curious, what was in your mind when you did resign? There must have been some sense of, I could have done better. And what do you look at as something that you wish you had done differently heading into January 6th or on that day? I mean, there, in addition to the Guard, I suppose one thing we've seen in Inspector General reports and others, there were 150 some officers on scheduled leave at the time. There was some old equipment that didn't function that day. Not everything was in the right spots. Not everything could be accessed. What was going through your head when you said, yeah, I'll step aside?
I was going to say that's a big, big question. So, you know, when you talk about the equipment, I talk about the equipment in the book about my attempts to, you know, get my men and women new equipment when I came on as their assistant chief, going through and identifying it because, you know, their CDU equipment was aging. Everyone didn't have what they call an air purifying respirator. Everyone wasn't issued a helmet. And I've been pushing to get budget. And think about it. From I came in 2017, January 2017, in 2020, I think it was September, October, we were able to identify $300,000 to buy everybody a riot helmet. Those riot helmets just happened to be coming in on January 6th ahead of time. Now, you know, post January 6th, the department got $106 million influx of money and a budget that, you know, my budget was $464 million. It's now $750 approximately. So they're not running short on money, which was an issue for me. You'll see it was an issue for the architect of the Capitol with physical security. So I was trying to get those resources in for my men and women. When Speaker Pelosi went up and called for my resignation, went through a lot of thought. They gave me a nice 2-minute heads up before it, and I talk about that. Had enough time to call my wife, warn her that she was going on it, going on national TV and calling for my resignation. But, you know, I had talked to a couple of people that have significant experience on the Hill. I did not want to leave. And I'll tell you, my men and women were upset. I still have people contact me after reading the book and saying, wow, I finally got to read the book and understand a little bit more about why you resigned. I felt I was being torn away from a department that I truly loved and had developed a lot of camaraderie with, and the morale was starting to improve. So I thought it was really bad timing. But, you know, with everything that was going on and the speaker going on national TV, one, calling for my resignation, saying there's a failure at the top, but then going in on and saying I haven't even called her, painting me as callous, disrespectful, possibly even complicit in the attack. That bothered me, knowing that I had talked to her 3 times. So I talked to my wife a little bit more, talked to some of the people up on the Hill, and determined, you know, I'll go ahead and submit my resignation. I didn't feel like I had done anything wrong. It wasn't that I didn't want the department to, you know, linger on anything that may have lingered with the transition or anything. If that's what the speaker wanted, and she's a very powerful person on the Hill, then so be it. What people don't realize is my separation date was actually supposed to be the 16th, so we can work out a transition. You know, get everybody up to speed. You know, I can, do an orderly exit. The very next day on January 8th, the acting Senate Sergeant Arms then called me and made my separation effective immediately.
Yeah, I remember reading that part. Happened a little faster than I think you expected. Yep. You also write about, looking back, you've been in better communication with some of your chiefs on some of these issues. You know, is there a lesson that you would, make sure that other law enforcement are hearing about complacency, about, even things that on the face of it don't necessarily seem any different intelligence-wise than the last thing? And obviously, you've seen a lot of big protests and other events come through D.C. Looking back, I mean, is there one thing that you'd say to other chiefs, in the years to come about that very issue of staying closer to the intelligence, staying closer to your command staff? Is there something there that we should be pushing forward?
You know, when you talk about staying close to my intelligence, you got to understand, I even had, one of the deputy chiefs from my intelligence briefing members of Congress on that Tuesday, indicating it was going to be similar to the previous 2 MAGA events. So, you know, it was tough when the intelligence wasn't portraying exactly what we now know it should have, how bad it was actually going to be. I would say, if I was to give advice to anyone going in, one, if you're going into a position where it could be politically aligned or political oversight for your agency, make sure you know exactly the chain of command, what restrictions you may face in bringing in things. I do think having the right people with the right capabilities in the right places always helps, whether it's intelligence, that may be one. But just, I look back on it, I think the intelligence agencies, mine included, could have done a better job. I think the Department of Defense, and you see that clearly in the book, I was extremely disappointed in their response. And then when we talk about the oversight structure, anytime you have people that aren't experts in security directing you how to handle security, that's a recipe for disaster, especially when it's influenced with politics.
Larry, you led me to my last question because we're almost out of time, but you also write that you're concerned that this could happen again. And I look at just the other day, Capitol Police removing the magnetometers from around the House chamber, and that being a decision, of course, that's more about politics and the rules that the lawmakers make for any given session. And there still is this construct with the Capitol Police Board and the Sergeants at Arms and others and the architect of the Capitol involved with making decisions about security. Do you fear this could happen again, that enough has been done to change the structure? Obviously, we know there has been this law passed now that your successors could call in the National Guard themselves. But what else, if there's one or two recommendations, do you think should be done?
I think it's interesting you bring up the magnetometers on the House floor. What a lot of people don't realize is there's magnetometers at every entrance to the Capitol. And every one of those entrances, the members of Congress bypass those magnetometers. So, you know, I think, it, like you had said, it was politics when they're put in, and it's politics when they're pulled out. I don't think it's an impact on security. Let's see. I think, I'm sorry, what was the other part of the question?
Oh, that's about it. Just going forward, this, you know, could it happen again?
Yeah, going forward, yeah, absolutely. The oversight, you need to work on that. I think the department's finally getting the equipment. You know, getting the training is going to be tough because he's short personnel, but getting the oversight to where that chief can make a decision. Yes, they passed the law. I'm glad they did. They made it revocable, which is interesting, but they passed that law, so that's a step in the right direction. But politics need to get out of security, and you need to let the chief make, you know, he's an experienced person. He needs to make security decisions on his own. And the intelligence, whether it's FBI, DHS, or my own intelligence, needs to portray the level of intelligence they have much clearer.
Well, thank you so much. Unfortunately, that is all the time we have.
Thanks for listening. For more information on our upcoming programs, go to WashingtonPostLive.com.